With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Team Human is an ad-free, listener-supported community project. People always ask me, how can I join Team Human? And I usually tell them, if you're alive, you're already on Team Human. Just go find the others. But if you want to get some skin in the game, I encourage you to go to teamhuman.fm and click on support to join teammates like Hannah Reese, TBC, Alan, Elmura, Ted Schulman, and Michael Cunningham, who've become supporting members and gained access to our Discord channel, our Team Human audio salons, as well as free admission to our Team Human live events. They're also getting access to the Team Human team feed with bonus content, including conversations I've had with everyone from Timothy Leary and Nina Graboy to Genesis Breyer-Peorage. You can even get books, t-shirts, and the knowledge that you're keeping a roof over our editor's head. So join Team Human. Gain access to our shared, clothing-optional Team Human dream space every night during your sleep. See you there. You're on Team Human, conscious intervention in the machine, a way station for those traveling in the liminal spaces between one and zero, yes and no, right and wrong, us and them, a freeform conversation and celebration of the art of conversation itself, a place where we can admit the deepest truth. I'm on Team Human. Are you? Playing for Team Human today, my friend, author and journalist David Zweig.
It is okay to recognize that bad things sometimes happen from something that overall is good.
Right.
Bad things happen on the highway every day, but we all get in our cars and go on the highway anyway because it does something good for us. It takes us to places we want to go, and we are willing to accept some risk.
David will be helping us parse the well-meaning but sometimes inaccurate communication from our health officials about COVID. Is the government becoming a helicopter parent? And don't helicopters make people paranoid? It's time to intervene on behalf of humans. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and we're all on Team Human. My accountant, Shelley Gordon, died Monday night. And it might not be the kind of news one would normally think about for too long, much less talk about here. You know, your accountant dies, you find another one. It's just business, right? But not really. You see, Shelley cared about me and my family in a way that really transcends what one might call a client relationship. And I promise he wasn't just doing the sorts of things that one might learn in a sales or customer relations course about sending calendars or Christmas gifts, making small talk, or remembering the name of someone's kids because they're in the contact database. No, Shelley merged his business and personal life, what Marx might call his economic and his social lives, in a way that made them indistinguishable. ethically, creatively, and yeah, sure, professionally. But there's a lesson here, I think, for people trying to do business in a more holistic way. But maybe there's even more of a lesson for people like me, these kind of Gen X people who are often at pains to distinguish between work and life, as if business and money somehow sully or compromise a genuine friendship. You know, we work for strangers, but we do favors for our friends. You know, don't mix business and pleasure, I've heard countless times growing up. But that ethos, this don't mix business and pleasure ethos, it's itself an artifact of a world where our work was intentionally disconnected from our social reality, where we started working for the man instead of working for one another. And Shelley, he worked in the opposite way. Every one of his clients became a member of his family. I mean, for real. I knew his sons, particularly the one who became the lawyer and the one who became an accountant like his dad. I knew his wife, who would wait with me on the phone instead of putting me on hold so she could inquire about my wife's health or reassure me that the latest letter from the IRS wasn't going to become a problem. My own dad was an accountant, and he did my taxes until he died. And Shelley took me on as if I were another son. He'd take my calls at any time, day or night, office or home, even when he was in Boca. He'd want to talk about my work, particularly when my books turned to business or the economy. He'd tell me what subjects he thought would be most useful to him as a reader. And I also like to think I was at least part of the reason he switched allegiances from the Yankees to the Mets after 70 years a diehard Yankee fan, because I convinced him it would be a greater challenge to be a Mets fan. But this wasn't the part of our relationship that was so unique to me. I mean, what made Shelley so special was the way he expressed his love and care for me through his work, his professional work on my behalf. When my wife and I got audited for our healthcare expenses, because the IRS, I think they simply couldn't believe how little our insurance actually reimbursed us, he took personal umbrage, and so did his wife and his kids, and he took personal pleasure in fighting for my family. It was a six-month battle with hundreds of pages of paperwork and diagnosis codes, prescription denials, and letters from doctors and explanations of benefits and bank statements. And I'll never forget the day he called me from his Florida condo to say, "Kid, they won't be bothering you again." He was gloating, not because he had brought the IRS to its knees, but because he had protected his kin from a predator. And this is the sort of business relationship that Marx was referring to when he wrote about our ways of working before capitalism. We didn't work for profit, but to enact equity. Our relationships were fundamentally social, not in the sense that we were friends, but that we were all contributing to the family enterprise together. So I might go kill a chicken and bring it home to my family, and they'd been making rice and tortillas all day. And between all of us, we'd get burritos. But only with the advent of the marketplace did we stop thinking about how genuinely useful we could be to one another and instead focus on how to maximize our exchange value. That's how much profit we could get in the deal. So yes, I paid Shelley for his services, but it was as if a fee structure didn't exist. It was simply my way of helping to pay the bills. We were in it together, contributing as best we could to each other's lives as if we were family. So yes, I'll miss the accountant who taught me the true meaning of the word accountability. Thank God his son is now my brother and my new accountant.
Music.
There's COVID madness all around us. And I don't just mean the people who are refusing to get vaxxed because they think Bill Gates put nanobots in there that can control and surveil them. I mean almost everyone in one way or another, trying to protect themselves and their kids or not protect themselves. My good friend and neighbor, David Zweig, has been writing rather controversial pieces about COVID policy for Wired and New York Magazine since the beginning of the outbreak. He's not questioning the science so much as the way that the science is being represented to us by our well-meaning authorities. It's as if they're so scared of the conspiracy theorists that they're overcorrecting and then generating more suspicions when eventually their misrepresentations or overrepresentations are revealed. It's a public relations conundrum and one that epidemiologists may not be the best trained people to be trying to do. We recorded this episode just before they approved vaccines for younger kids, so keep that in mind when you get to that section.
You know, the first thing I really knew about you, it's really interesting, and it's a very team human book you wrote about the Invisibles. The Invisibles, the fun thing about it was about, I mean, not just unsung heroes, but on the one hand, it's sort of like Studs Terkel sort of working, or the Marissa Beaux and John Beaux book, Gig, mm-hmm. You know, that here are people and here's what they do, and weird jobs that maybe you never even knew existed.
Exactly. What particularly interested me were people who were highly skilled professionals, but who chose professions or fell into professions and thrived there, where their work, that the better they did, the less recognition they would get. And if they were perfect, generally the end user or other people would never think of them at all. So when you think about a fact checker, for example, if you do your job perfectly, no one's reading a magazine article and saying to themselves, oh, this must have been fact-checked beautifully. No, right. You just read it and you enjoy the writing and maybe you can appreciate the editing to some degree. But no one's saying, but if you read an article and there's like a glaring error, then you're aware of like, who fact-checks this thing? This is done right. Horribly. And same thing with an anesthesiologist. Everything goes smoothly. The people, you know, they don't send the fruit basket to the anesthesiologist. My dad's a surgeon. And it's like we would always get these fruit baskets sent to the house. I'm like, what's that for? He's like, a patient thanking me. I'm like, didn't they pay you? Yeah, they paid me, but they also, it's like an extra thanks. I'm like, wow, that's great. But so you'll never forget the name of the person who removed your gallbladder, right. Probably, but you've no idea the name of the anesthesiologist.
You might not even have met him, and that was the right. Person at the head of the table keeping you alive.
Right.
Well, yeah, I mean, I worked in an operating room when I was in college, and there are these people, the heart-lung people. Mm. There's this machine that when you get an open heart surgery, there's two people that run this machine. It looks like a metal coffin or something on the side of the room, and they are totally responsible. They are your heart. Right. All the thing is going on.
Exactly.
You know, and it is high skilled. It's like, right. Fuck. And it's like, but most people who do heart surgery don't even know those people exist.
Right. So, and the same thing with, again, there's a reason why it's called like a Starkitect for the architects. Yeah. I did, this has less life and death ramifications, but one of the people I did a profile on the book is what's called a nose in the perfume industry. These are the people who concoct the fragrances in a lab. I mean, and it's sort of this brilliant mixture of art and science, because there's an art to thinking about how you want to conjure up a certain type of feeling and so on. And then there's a science behind it to actually understand. They use the mass spectrometer and right. Putting together all this stuff. But of course, when someone goes to the store and buys a Dolce & Gabbana, you know, perfume, they're not thinking about that person. They think right. Dolce & Gabbana
they
made it,
Dolce,
but they
know Dolce or Gabbana, maybe Johnny Depp or whoever it is.
One of them, you know, was
the ad.
They're grinding with a mortar and pestle, you know, some rose leaves or something. But it's like, so there are all these people. And what was fascinating to me is our culture values recognition so highly. And I thought it was interesting. Again, the reason why I chose people, most of whom were very successful, but who weren't generally recognized for their work, at least not by the end user. Yeah. Within their own fields, they had recognition and their peers knew about them, but the end user isn't often thinking about them, is that this was, and I think the line I had in the book was that these people were both the antithesis and the antidote, I feel, to this sort of like just constant striving for attention. I need attention right. all the time. And of course, lo and behold, all the sort of, you know, psychological research and what I think probably a lot of the religious traditions and all the philosophy, what it tells us is that the way to really achieve a satisfying life, I think the word in Greek, you would know this, Doug, eudaimonia,
yeah.
probably pronouncing it incorrectly, but that's, it's the rich life. And the way to get that is not through these sort of externalized benefits of attention, but through an intrinsic reward of the work itself
right.
and the value
it's,
you bring.
Exactly. It's, that's, you know, whether it's flow, right. you know, yes, in flow state or Alfie Kohn, who mm-hmm. did all this great work on the difference between intrinsic and extrinsic rewards right. at work or right. in school, and too much assessment and evaluation, and it distances people from the sort of the zen moment-to-moment pleasure of just picking the berries or doing whatever. And it doesn't have to be, again, it can be so-called low-skilled, but all low-skilled means is that you don't need a high level of skill to be entry-level. Even if you're just picking berries for 30 years, I promise you the 30-year berry picker is picking berries very differently right. than the third week right. berry
yes,
picker. You know,
indeed.
So you do right. develop, you know, deep Andre Segovia level skills. Yeah, I use him as a, right. as a, he's a guitarist, right. but he was like really good, you know, Pablo Casals level skills. But the thing that made me think about it again now, especially in the context of Team Human, is so many people email me with their ideas for things. A blockchain social network that will help people, blah, 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 blah. A website that will concatenate and aggregate all the social justice websites that blah, 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 blah. A new way for race and gender, da, 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 da. And none of them seem to want to join existing efforts. I'll say, oh, well, you know, I've got 30 other emails from people who are developing almost identical platforms of what you're describing. Do you want to work with them? Can I connect you with them? I say, well, will they fund me? Will they? It's like, no, it's like you can all be part, but this desire, and it's a well-meaning desire that it's as if the only models they have in society for doing good are these Greta level, you know.
Well, do you think, hearing you say this about people writing into, I have this idea and I want that, even if they're not consciously seeking recognition or glory for it, maybe some of them are consciously, yeah. but even on one level or another, how much of that has to do with American style individualism, do you
right.
think, Doug? I mean,
it's
like, to
be,
me,
it's gotta
I mean,
be.
It's so that integrated in our way then, of viewing
right.
ourselves and the world and like what's important and what we value, that, you know, the sort of YouTuber, you know, like everything is this.
Well, it's amplified by social media.
For
and,
sure.
And that.
Versus, I mean, the more kind of quote collectivist cultures where there's a real, not only value, but that there's a respect for blending in and being part of, quote, a team human.
Yeah.
Do you think American style individualism, which is now probably bled throughout, you know, the globe in many respects, do you think that in particular is a kind of an affront to Team Human? Is that one of the obstacles?
It is. It's funny. I saw they interviewed this guy. I forgot his last name now. Zach something. He's the new quarterback on the Jets. And he's this kid, right? He's right out of college. Gorgeous. I mean, I don't know how you maintain a gorgeous face like that and play football.
There's a right? disproportionate number, my wife always talks about this, of handsome quarterbacks.
And I guess it's part of it.
It must relate to, if you are good looking, that helps you become a leader in our
confident
society.
In some way, right.
Feedback, there is, if someone, and I don't know how to like, I'm sure some social yeah. scientists could like do yeah. some sort of study, but if you look at like NFL quarterbacks, a disproportionate number of them, it's not that they're just athletic, they're handsome.
You almost never see an yeah. ugly one. But anyway, so
right.
anyway,
okay.
they interviewed him after, because he did all these passes and stuff that
okay.
were good. And they're like, dude, you're really good. And he's like, I have these four huge men that stand there and give me time to throw. And it was like, thank you.
Right.
It's like, right, it's those guys who you don't know their names. Right. I mean, well, real those fans do.
So I was going to do a, what is it, a left tackle? That's the like most important guy on the team. Someone's going to be like, he's saying the wrong position.
It's the right tackle.
It's the giant guy who's directly to the left of the center. That tends to be the most important blocker for the quarterback.
I guess for a right-handed quarterback, probably.
I think I read about maybe this guy at the Giants, or maybe this is a typical thing where before each game, like on Saturday night, the quarterback buys all their front line steaks or something. So like, or maybe it's after the game, they do a good job, but to like keep them happy, these guys are going to protect me.
Yeah, I know. And it's that. And it's funny because here I am as the, you know, the host of Team Human and all that. And I mean, it was part of the reason why I refused at the beginning to call this like the Doug Rushkoff. They wanted me to call it Rushkoff Radio
Hour.
Right? Yeah. Like, you know, the Rogan Show or the whatever. It's like, no, I'm not going to use my name. It's like they had to force me to put, you know, like with Doug Rushkoff on one of the things, because it was like, no, it's got to be I want to be invisible.
Well, yeah, that would kind of undermine part of the premise behind Team Human if it was like Doug Rushkoff presents Team Human. It's like loses Bill
Graham,
a little bit.
Bill Graham presents The Grateful Dead.
So can I tell you like a funny little thing that I think connects with this? So before I got into writing, I played music for a good decade or so in New York, mostly recorded some albums out in Chicago, and I played under my name. It was David Zweig, you know, but I had a band with me. It was symphonic stuff. So one of my biggest regrets is that I didn't perform under just some sort of pseudonym, the way like there was a band I loved called Sparkle Horse. I mean, the guy's name is Mark Linkus, who, you know, he was Sparkle Horse. And there's like, you know, 50 different things like this where there's, the name, but it's really just one person. But, you know, Nine Inch Nails is really just Trent Reznor, for example, even though his name is, of course, famous now. I regret at the time not just making up some sort of band name, even though it was just me. And I think it's because, you know, at the time I was 22 or something when I started playing, I was insecure, and I was like, I couldn't tolerate the idea that people might not know it's me. Wait, they're going to think that's how immature and insecure I was.
Well, especially the people you knew, like from college. If you got big, you want to make sure that all those kids who didn't, you know.
I can't play under the name, you know, some thing. And I've always regretted that. Even while I was playing live, half of me regretted doing that. But it's something that I think ties into what we're talking about. It's like one of those things where you have to have a degree of secure. Is it not only about that wanting to kind of be part of something larger? Is it not only about a collectivist mindset, but is it also about a certain level of maturity and security? Because at least for me, I view it. I mean, I love the feeling of being part of something, but it was just that like, it was like, I need the recognition. Yeah. I need to make sure. And now I feel like I don't care about that as much.
Yeah, well,
And I'm a little embarrassed about it now as I look back.
Well, yeah, but those were values that that trickled down to us from from economics. We were looking at our parents. Everyone has their own 401k plan, right? It's not like a pension from the big company anymore. Right. It's the collectivist retirement. So individual.
It makes sense. You feel, and particularly, without the lack of a social safety net and blah, blah, blah. Right.
There is no us.
Right. So you need. It makes sense that a 22-year-old who's writing all the music and coming up with all the arrangements and all the stuff is going to feel, hey, I need the attention from myself.
Yeah, it was weird.
Outlandish to feel that way.
And I get it. We is intrinsically repressive to the rights and freedoms of the individual.
Well,
you know, of course, we know that, I mean, we listening and we in this room know that the only way for me to actually be me fully is in a we, because I need the others to recognize me. I mean, that's part of the expression of the individual is.
That's Sartre. He's like, you don't exist essentially unless other people are watching you and judging you, but yet although they are there to make you exist, that is the hell as other people is the notion that you're constantly, that your existence relies upon others' view of you.
I guess just view of you, but it relies on your ability to engage responsibly on their behalf.
Right.
All of the invisibles are to me, what held them in common was how deeply responsible they are to other human beings who will never understand. It's like the mother with the child not letting the kid do something. The kid thinks the mother's just being mean, but the mother's being responsible.
Right, right.
You know, and that they show up for us even though we don't acknowledge them. That's true we-ness.
It's interesting hearing you bring, you know, us chatting about Invisibles, which I don't think about as often these days. But in the context of the work I've been doing with during the pandemic,
right.
Because one of the big things, you know, that this sort of political divide, at least the perception of it, is that, you know, and this ties into political theory, yeah. is the notion of liberty, you know, personal liberty versus other values, like, you know, law and order versus, you know, communal values. And that in America, it's like, I want my freedom. Period. And that means I don't have to do X, whatever right. X is, whether it's wear a mask, whether it's be vaccinated. And by the way, some of those things, we can get into that. The science,
yeah.
I think, people have legitimate concerns and criticisms.
Yeah.
But the driving force behind it, I think, is not right. an understanding of the science, but more of this deeply ingrained American sense of I have my rights as an individual. And barring very extreme circumstances, those rights trump all other communal rights.
But to COVID, right, there's this landscape now, not just disinformation and misinformation, but a landscape of, and we all know, you know, where putting on a mask, whether it works or not, putting on a mask feels like a symbol of acquiescence to Hillary Clinton and the pederast Epstein totalitarian dominators, you know, that are coming for my tractor and my wife and my freedom.
So here's where I think part of the real sticky kind of more complex stuff enters in though. So
right.
the impetus initially, if we think back a year and a half ago, is like, you know, F this, I'm not wearing a mask or whatever, you know, for all these reasons we just talked right. about, this sort of like libertarian kind of like, I should be allowed to do what I want. But where things then start to break down is that when you start drilling into the science, which is what I've done on a lot of these things, that there isn't necessarily a good scientific reason for all of these things that they're wanting to burden society with. Some of them do and some don't.
Right.
And there's a strong lack of nuance in how the public health authorities talk about this. And then the sort of kind of just mainstream medical establishment talks about some of these things. And when you polish away all of the kind of important details, you are left with a very kind of binary messaging on a whole variety of things. And then what happens is, and Doug, you and I have talked about yeah. this before, is that the people who are already have their kind of like hackles up about this, and they're already
yeah.
concerned about these impositions on them. And a lot of these people, or at least some of them, are very smart
yeah.
and very motivated to look at the actual data. They're motivated to read the studies and know what's going on. And they will seize upon the inconsistencies and the inaccuracies of some of the public health statements, you know, in a snap. And by not being more precise and nuanced in the messaging, they end up doing, the health authorities end up doing more harm than they should be doing.
So it's tricky though, because there's the way they communicate, which is sometimes really bumbling. There's what behavior and thing they're actually thinking about before they communicate. And then there's just the wrong stuff that they say. And those combine in a really bad way. So it's like, you know, COVID first happens and people think, oh, I'm going to get, you know, an ND96, whatever. I'm going to get some special mask, right? And everybody's running to True Value right. and Ace Hardware. Right. And you get all these masks. And Fauci and those guys go, oh, fuck. If people buy up all the masks, then the ambulance people aren't going to have masks. And, you know, masks are, it's not really, whatever. You don't need it. So they go out on TV. Don't get masks. Don't wear masks. You don't need masks. Don't wear masks. It's all fine. Because and I understand. Because they're like, they probably should have said, please save the masks for the people who really, really need them. Yeah, they would help you a little bit and whatever. But come on, be nice. Be nice. So then they say, then eventually there's enough masks or whatever, maybe enough PPE or some, and they kind of, oh, well, actually you should wear masks.
Right. Turns out.
But then everybody's like, well, wait a minute. You said no masks. Now you're saying yes masks. So which is it? Which right. is it?
It's like the original sin of the pandemic.
It was the original sin.
Was the Fauci flip-flop on the mask. And as you just noted, it would have been fine if A, the scientific, you know, evidence had changed, which it hadn't. And they're like, look, things have changed. It turns out it is effective. Or B, if they were honest and said, look, the people who work in hospitals and ambulances, whatever, these people need specific gear to help protect them, or at least we believe this to be the case. Please don't buy any of that stuff. You can buy a cloth mask off of Etsy or something, or make one yourself out of your underwear if you feel like it. But please don't buy any of those. But be honest. But instead, they didn't say that. They didn't say that. Right. He said, you don't need them. And this has happened over and over and over again with the CDC or with Fauci and with a whole, you know, slew of physicians who are now on television all the time, where they repeat things with such certainty, with such binary assuredness, and they're wrong over and over again, and it ends up hurting them because the people who I was just talking about, and some of whom who I correspond with and who I know and who I really like and who I share views with, that some of these, they spot this in a second. It gives them something to grab onto and say, this is bullshit and here's why. Instead, had they been honest, if you air everything out from the beginning, then there's nothing for those people to grab onto. But so what it really shows is an utter disregard for the sort of, I don't know, intelligence isn't the right word, but a disregard just for the average American to be able to take in some basic messaging and, quote, do the right thing. So two questions. Yeah. One, is it justified? And two, even if it is justified to not actually give the real information, I think it's very evident that not giving the correct information actually became more harmful.
Right. In the long term. But the thing is, there's the real science. Then there's the decisions that authorities have made in what they believe is our best total interest about what behaviors they want to engender in us. So they decide that wearing masks is good for, you know, adults in small rooms at work. It's going to stop disease. The only way we're going to get adults to wear masks, and this is what they decide, is not to tell them when exactly it's important, but let's just get everyone wearing masks all the time. So in those 50% of situations where we need it, they're going to do it. And then they come up with a communication strategy. And this is why I keep thinking about Walter Lippmann. You know, Walter Lippmann's he was a progressive. Everyone forgets that. He was a true progressive, not Bernie-esque progressive, but pretty progressive for the time. And he believed people just were just not really educated and smart and rational enough to make the best choices on our own behalf. You know, that we are in Plato's cave. He always wrote about Plato's cave, that we're just looking at pictures in our heads and making decisions randomly based on that. So what the government needs is a council of experts, of doctors and scientists and whoever, expert PhDs, to figure out what is best for the people.
And they're going to make those shadow puppets on the wall in the cave with the candle.
Exactly. And then convince us to do it. You know, and that was the original example is World War I. But people voted against the war and brought in Woodrow Wilson. And then Woodrow Wilson said, oh, actually, we better get involved in that war. And then they had to do PR. So I think
Bernays?
Yes, this was, he was Bernays's mentor.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then Bernays went on the Creel Commission that Lippmann advised and started and took Lippmann's well-intentioned propagandistic efforts.
He's like, how can we use this to sell
Benson and Hedges to women?
Exactly. Torches of freedom. Right. Okay.
which is the whole thing. It's like, once you develop the weapon, bad people are going to start using it.
But I think even if Lippmann was well-intentioned, this, again, thinking politically, this is the thing that conservatives, I think, by and large, and libertarians bristle at, this idea, this paternalistic notion of, like, we know best as the government, just listen to us. And the government knowingly giving misleading information with the idea that that will bring about the results they want. As you just gave an example, you know, this is, but right. We only want people to wear a specific type of mask in a specific type of situation. We don't think the American public is capable of following that instruction. Therefore, we'll just say everyone wear a mask all the time because that's the only way to achieve that goal.
Right, exactly. And it's the way you do like peanut allergy rules in elementary schools. It's like, okay, look, this is just too hard. No peanuts within 3 miles of the school, period.
So, and the term for that, I think I've heard is the noble lie that it's okay to bullshit a little bit or bend things a little bit as long because it's noble. This is a worthwhile cause because we know that this is the correct thing. This is the end result we want. And we can say whatever we need to say to achieve that final result.
It's like parents to a child. I mean, you shouldn't say, don't open that door because there's a monster behind that closet.
Right.
You know, there's a monster in there. Right. Oh, no. Because you're going to damage the child forever. You know, which is why I always thought Santa Claus was such a terrible strategy for Christians. It's like, have kids believe in this guy that's going to see if you're doing good or not and then reward you at the end. Say, oh, no, Santa's not real. Don't worry. But God is real. And St. Peter's real.
You know, and also when they inevitably find out that Santa Claus isn't real, there is some sort of like fundamental sense, I believe, that like the kids internalize, oh, I've been lied to.
Exactly. My parents lied to me. My priest lied to me.
Everyone, oh, this was just a fun thing. Really? I really believed in that. I don't know. It is funny how this is this construct. Well, you got two Jews here. What do we know?
Maybe
there's some, we're
it's
just,
good for you
we're just bitter. Maybe it's
no,
a
and maybe it's
thing.
About teaching disillusionment so that.
Oh, we're going to purposefully lie to you about this wonderful man who brings you presents because it's beneficial for you to then have that taken away from you to learn.
So you won't fall in the spell of the demagogue.
Exactly. This is a way to keep from worshiping false things.
Just so we're clear here, you don't believe Bill Gates is putting nanobots in things that he intentionally created COVID in order
not
to
a
make
microchip.
Us, and Biden didn't make a deal with the Chinese to infect Americans to take down Trump. I mean, you don't go to any of those places.
The vaccines, and I'll start off by saying this, that, you know, all available evidence suggests that the vaccines are incredibly safe. Also, they appear to be very beneficial for most of the population once you become an adult, that when you look at the risk benefit ratio, you are better off getting vaccinated than you are getting COVID and getting natural immunity. Now, does that mean that everyone who gets COVID, even if you're an adult, is going to be horribly sick? No, it does not. And it also doesn't mean that some adults who get vaccinated won't have bad results as well. But if you look at the data and you weigh it out on a scale, you know, on each side, it's going to tip slowly that benefit and risk shifts as you get younger and younger for most people, or if, you know, depending on what your underlying conditions are. So
you mean, so the younger you are, the less sick you get and the less relatively beneficial it is to be vaccinated.
Well, by and large, yes. Right. There are some kids who will get sick, unfortunately, and there are some a very, very small number who even have died.
Right.
But yeah, correct. The numbers show that, and we've known this for a year and a half.
It doesn't mean kids shouldn't be vaccinated, but you're just saying right now that the risk-benefit ratio is different for kids.
It's very different. It's not even a little different. It's very different.
Okay.
And so
which is why probably they haven't yet approved 2 to 12.
So here,
our horrible government of terrible people are still being thoughtful enough to say, let's wait here.
Despite the pressure being put on them. So, I mean, there are doctors who are, you know, have parents, you know, pediatricians have parents begging them to give them,
bribing them probably.
Off-labeled to their 10-year-old because they're freaking out. There are two reasons. So they just expanded the trial for the kids below 12. They said, and there are only two reasons to expand a trial. One is if there's a safety signal and we need to, you know, and they need to adjust the dosage and get more people in, that like something's going wrong. Or two is that they're not finding it to be particularly efficacious, that children are at such low risk of serious disease or even symptomatic disease. The CDC estimated that around up to 50% of kids are asymptomatic. Imagine that. a virus yeah. that half the kids who get it don't even know when they have it. So that's a really high bar to clear with the vaccine.
We're supposed to be scared, though. The kids don't have it, but they got all the pus and snot and stuff with all the COVIDs in it. And then they walk into a barber shop and give it to all the old men.
Well, those people should be vaccinated if they're adults and protecting themselves. The vaccine is not does not offer perfect protection, as we know now, against Delta. It doesn't even seem to offer protection against infection, but it still does, by all the evidence.
Makes you not die.
Supposedly, or it helps reduce the risk of serious illness.
Helps me not die is still good to me.
Still a good thing, exactly. So again, the vaccine makes sense. The higher risk you have, the more it makes sense to get to be vaccinated.
Yeah.
But as you go down, the risk decreases and decreases. So the reason they've expanded the trial from my sources who I speak with, and these are not like weird fringe people, these are people at places like Harvard Medical School and other, is that most likely it means they've been having trouble with the small number of people finding that the vaccine is really outperforming placebo by any large measure.
Right.
So you have, and in order for the FDA to approve a vaccine, it has to show safety and that it's effective. So, so by increasing the numbers, fine. Then if you need 10,000 or 100,000, you know, eventually hopefully we'll start to see a signal and that it makes sense. So that's why that's taking longer. The data shows is that younger people, and in particular young males, this is, you know, from age whatever. I think that most of the data was actually not starting at the 12-year-olds, but from 16 before they approved the EUA for down to 12, but just 16 to say like 30-year-olds or 16 to 25 or 22, that their incidence of myocarditis was,
which is like a heart inflammation?
Correct. It's an inflammation of the heart. And then there's something called pericarditis, which is the inflammation of the muscle or the lining, the sac, the lining around the heart. But generally that the incidence of myocarditis was completely off the charts relative to what you would expect to see if people weren't vaccinated in this particular population. And what they found was, and these are in the CDC's own slides that they showed during their advisory committee meeting. So you can access all of this stuff online and the slideshow, and you see it broken down by gender and by age. And what you see, and I'm speaking off the cuff here, so the numbers might be off by a little bit, but roughly what they found was, like, out of a million, that the young males, like 16 to 20 something, had an incidence of something like 62 or 68 cases of myocarditis following vaccination, when the expected number was like, you know, 5 or something like that, or 3. And then young women had something like 8 cases. Now, so let's position this here. Again, the numbers, I might be off by 1 or 2, but essentially it was like 60 something for young males and it was 8 for young females. But what the CDC did was, Rochelle Walensky went on television and after the meeting happened, she said, here's what we know. She said, look, myocarditis, not a big deal. The cases are all mild. Not all the cases are mild. And in fact, I spoke to a number of cardiologists and one of them said, there is no such thing as mild myocarditis. Right. So maybe clinically.
Bernie's mild heart attack.
Right. There's no such thing. Let me ask any parent who's listening to this. If you have a child who's having a heart condition and they are in the intensive care unit, would you ever describe that as a mild condition?
Right.
No. So maybe clinically they can describe that, you know, the medical professionals, but a regular person does not define the word mild in that manner.
Right.
So nevertheless, she refers to it as, you're going to see 30 something cases of mild myocarditis for every million kids, you know, people who are getting the vaccine. Don't sweat it. But what she did was, she took, how do you get 30 something? Well, if you average out the 60 something for the young males with the like 8 of the young females, that's how you get 30 something.
Right.
So she's essentially burying the signal. And this, you know, I spoke with a number of epidemiologists. So I was like, is that normal? Is that? And they said, no, that is not. When there is very, very clear, beautifully precise data for different age cohorts or different genders. And then what's interesting is, Doug, they took it it a step further. In the summary slide at the end of the presentation, not only did they merge the male and females, they took it from, I don't know if it was either age 12 or 16, whatever the base age was, all the way up to 39. And then they said, look, there's only 12 cases. This is amazing. There's only 12 cases of myocarditis. Right. They buried the signal of, so yes, if you are a person, a human being between, you know, whatever it was, 12 or 16, all the way up to 39, you have, there's a chance that right. 12 of those people. But if you are a young male,
right,
age 16 to like 24 or whatever it is, then it's 60. So if you're a person and you have a healthy 15-year-old son, he was a lacrosse yeah. player, whatever, yeah. you know, handsome young buck is going to be a quarterback. you have a healthy boy. Do you want to be told, oh, well, look, there's only 12 cases out of a million, or because they're burying this right. particular signal, or do you want to be told the truth, which is your son, because he's a boy and he's within this certain age bracket, has a completely different risk profile than a 38-year-old woman.
Well, it's completely different. I want to be told if they're gonna mandate the vaccine, I want to be told the comforting thing.
Okay. Well, then, right. Well, that's
right? Set, right. But there you go. But that's the whole thing.
Littman,
so
right.
they're trying to set up. Right. They're trying to set up a situation where everyone goes and gets the vaccine. They want everyone to get it, even if there's that risk. They don't want parents of boys saying, well, I don't want to do it because he's a boy. And then if they found out that like Jewish boys have 30%
right.
chance and,
right.
you know, black Jewish kids have 70% chance, they're going to not say that either.
I don't know. I mean, there is, by the way, someone could still have their 15-year-old healthy son vaccinated. That's still an entirely reasonable decision. That is not crazy. But similarly, it is also not crazy to say, if I have a healthy 15-year-old son, I'm not going to do it.
I'm going
to
make a different decision. Or at
that
least,
is not unreasonable.
At least the thing with, you know, with like, I remember with amniocentesis and you know, fetuses, you know, that you can do amniocentesis and find out if you have a Down's baby or something. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that you're going to necessarily abort mm-hmm. even, but you at least know, oh, we've got a high-risk pregnancy.
Right. What does this
we
mean?
Need this information. So, and it's going to change the way we move forward. So just, you know, denying the information is kind of criminal when people are trying to make intelligent choices for themselves and their families. But the presumption here is that people, individuals, uneducated, non-MD, regular Americans should not be making those decisions for themselves.
Well, so let me add two other things. Again, I want to emphasize, I am not anti-vax. I am vaccinated myself. This is not, and the fact
and I
want that
to get
I feel,
to that too, that you have
that
to say
I feel
it.
The need to add this sort of like, you know, qualifier or like sort of like defensive, like preamble, like just before yeah. I start, let me say I'm not against vaccine. Like that's a problem in and of itself, that the public conversation is so stilted. And these are things that people should be informed, because these yeah, ultimately aren't MD questions.
No,
these are ethical
yeah,
and philosophical
choices. But they go back
choices.
To the original philosophical thing we were talking about, which is the relationship of the individual to the herd.
Mm.
Right now, public health officials are not looking at individuals as individuals. They are looking at America as this one organism, right? And here are these cells over there you're talking about. Oh, look at those boys, are these cells over in the liver. And the liver really doesn't like when we give this medicine. But
oh, is the
rest
metaphor
of the
America is a body? Is
yes.
that your metaphor?
Well,
okay,
they're doctors.
Okay, I was just
they
following.
Look at everything
okay,
like, right, right America okay. is this body. And okay. yeah, you know, you got you know, a fungal infection, we're going to give you this Lamisil tablet to take right. for 6 weeks.
Right.
It does liver damage.
Right.
You know?
It's systemic. Right. Because it's an interesting metaphor, because some medication we take is, you know, if you take an antibiotic, it's you're taking a pill. Or if you're in the hospital, it could be intravenous, yeah. but whatever. But it's this, it's going through your whole body.
Right. And that's the way they look at the.
If you
right.
have a scrape on your arm, you can right. take that, you know, Neosporin, and that's localized.
Right, it's local. But that's right. the way they're looking at the disease. They're looking at this big pandemic thing. Right. And if those people over there don't have vaccines, oh no, it's mutating and turning into this other shit, you know, and that's going to affect this side. They're looking at the whole, how do we just, I mean, it's almost Trump style. How do we bleach the nation? How
right,
do we
right.
cover the whole thing? It's a medical philosophy. philosophy. And that leads to these kind of untruths. Right. Right? But then
the noble lie.
Then my question to you is, you've now made a career, if you will, but not really. You've focused as an investigative journalist on noble lies, or perhaps potentially, hopefully, at least.
According to many experts who I speak with.
At least
with.
We hope that they're noble, right? But lies, you know, and let's give them the good, at least to believe that Fauci is not doing this to personally profit, that Fauci and Rochelle and whoever, they believe, mm-hmm. at least in their heart of hearts, that this is somehow good, right, for everybody on a health level, and that they're making this political, ethical, systemic, organismic, cultural, social choice.
Right.
So how do you then criticize it without, I mean, the thing that always upsets me is I'll see you do a piece with these factual things that mm-hmm. are true. Mm-hmm. And then among the many brilliant Harvard educated doctors who will quote and tweet and retweet and heart and all that stuff, all the people who've been very deeply disillusioned by government and civilization jump in to say, you see, Bill Gates' nanos of this, that it fuels. How do we bring the bad news to people without fueling this conspiracy people? I mean, and is it our responsibility?
I don't know the answer. However, one of the things that I think or hope is part of the answer is what I've been doing since the very beginning of the pandemic is I wonder, Doug, if part of the answer to that question is that we must continue to not be so solipsistic and this American exceptionalism. And one of the things that I've been writing about from day one and that I wrote about in my masking article, and even I touch on in the, it's funny now that I'm recalling it and speaking with you, the vaccine article. So let me jump back to the vaccines. One of the interesting things is many other countries in Europe, that you know, are sort of our peer type of nations, places we respect, that liberals
that
love.
Have real cars and TVs
Guess
and everything.
What?
Yeah.
They did not. Approved the vaccines immediately the way we did down to 12 years old. They did not say, everybody just get vaccinated, two doses, boom, do it, full same strength, everything, go. They did not have the same program that we had. In fact, many of those countries still have not approved the vaccine for general use among children down to 12 years old, the way we have. Some of the countries have said only kids with underlying conditions. Whoa, here's the thing I was just talking about. Now, I suspect some portion of your listeners, when I said that 5-10 minutes ago, were like, who's this asshole anti-vax person? Yeah. He's some jerk off. But please be aware, countries in Western Europe that we respect actually have the same policy that I was just talking about, where they said, no, let's look at the risk benefit calculation. And hey, here's what we've come up with. We think only kids with underlying conditions, those are the only people. And other ones said, let's do one dose and then we'll see, because most of these cases of myocarditis and other things happen after the second dose. So this is nuance that's happening. In Europe.
Right. So they do nuance over there, but because they can handle the truth.
Right. So this gets to my point, is that I try to always look at what's happening elsewhere.
Right.
And I can't help but wonder, I can't know if that's going to turn off the Bill Gates microchip people, but I hope that that helps penetrate the sort of regular normie kind of, you know, New York Times reading audience, like my mom and dad or whatever, that like, when I say, hey, wait a minute, did you know that the World Health Organization has repeatedly throughout the pandemic said, we do not want kids wearing masks under 6, period. And that's dramatically different from the CDC and the American Academy of Pediatrics, who want two-year-olds and three-year-olds wearing masks. So people need to have an awareness that outside the US, the policies for vaccine, the policies for masking children are very different from what they are here. And many countries, and I listed them, you can go on their government websites and look it up. They do not require children at varying age. Some of them are below 6. Some of them are below 12. Some of them are kids don't have to wear masks, period, all the way up through high school, except maybe when you're in like the hallways in public areas, but when you're classroom self. So there's this whole range of policies regarding masking children that are very different from here in the US. And these are by countries that have, you know, that are politically liberal. There is nothing inherently right-wing or Trumpian about saying, hey, wait a minute, I'm not sure it's a good idea for my five-year-old to be wearing a mask all day, every day in school for now what's going on a year and a half of his or her life. There's nothing inherently Trumpian about that. That is literally the conclusion that these countries we respect and look up to have come to.
Right, the social, whatever they are, social democracies.
Bringing this to light, because so much of the reportage and so much on COVID, but I guess everything is just about what's happening in America. So if you read an article in a prestigious publication and they only mention, here's what the CDC says, and you need to listen to the CDC, or if you don't, you're just some Trump jerk off, like lunatic libertarian person, that you need to listen to the CDC. How dare you question them? But what the article leaves out is, oh, but by the way, the World Health Organization differs dramatically from what the CDC recommends. Does the CDC know something that the WHO doesn't? Maybe, but I doubt that's the case. And here's something that all these other countries are doing differently than we're doing here. And that context is continually left out of so many of these COVID articles. So every single thing I write, I try to always bring up what other countries are doing. And it's not that other countries don't have their own unique circumstances and that you can't always apply what's happening in France or the UK to here, but they are humans.
Right.
And
but those are people, those are countries where you pay before you go on the subway or the bus and they don't even check.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Right. These are countries where their sense of cooperation is so much higher than ours. I think that the Lippmann argument would be, look, Americans, we're too stupid. You know, we're too uncooperative. We need simple yes, no. I mean,
that is literally guidance has been
Europe,
here. Everyone wear a goddamn mask or you're a piece of
but
shit
look at the difference.
Trying to kill people. But if you're a two-year-old not wearing a mask.
I know. I look at that on MSNBC and they always say, oh, look at the disease, the maskless are killing us all.
Yeah.
Right. But America has
horrible
traffic lights, right? Stop or go. You go to Europe, they have these things called traffic circles.
The roundabout,
The roundabout. And they're super efficient. You go, and there's only two rules, right? You yield right of way to people who are in it, and you go to the right. Mm-hmm. And you go around this thing, and you don't have to stop. It's not like stop or go. It's just like you work it out, and everything circulates, like blood circulating in a body. It's like they can negotiate that. For some reason, maybe it's because we had such wide open spaces. I don't know, but we went for the simple traffic light, green or red.
But the data shows that when they implement traffic circles in America, they work very well here as
they
well.
Still
if
do.
They're designed properly, they're just not popular. But, you know, they just haven't been able to. So I guess what I'm saying is the reason we don't have the roundabout here is not because we can't handle a roundabout.
Right.
It's just because who knows why it was done, but it's not because the
Americans are intrinsically DNA-wise unable to cooperate.
Look, I've driven in the heart of Paris before when you're going around the Arc de Triomphe and these other circles. It's pretty damn chaotic. They do not, the drivers there, and there's this highway in Montevideo in Uruguay where it's like 7 lanes wide and there were no lines painted. And I was white knuckling the steering wheel and I'm like, holy shit. And you know what? It was a bit chaotic. It was scary. I guess my point is they're not doing a fabulous job at the roundabouts either. I think we overestimate the sort of like unique stupidity of Americans. I think most people are stupid everywhere.
Right.
We are not uniquely barbaric here relative to other places. I think we can handle the roundabouts. And I think we can handle saying that a two-year-old, should not be wearing a mask.
I like the idea that you're seeing part of your responsibility as a journalist in order to fix the situation is to help pull back the lens and help America see itself as one of many nations and to see what's happening around the world in other places. I mean, that's an argument I use for our internet use a lot, too. It's like, oh, look, you know, Europe's working on privacy regulations. We could work on that, too, or think about that. Or, you know, so it's a great, I mean, and Rick Maxwell at Queens College, he's always, you know, international studies is the way to go. We've got to see how other countries do it and see it as a world, not as a nation. So
public utility, sort of like the town, like, aren't there these townships owning their own internet pipes now?
All sorts of other stuff that other people are doing that we could do too if we thought about other countries and how they do things there. And I think that solipsism is real, but it's really tricky to tell the truth. I mean, this has been, in some ways, it's been the Jewish problem for 1,000 or more years. It's like, are you going to tell them they're worshiping a rock doll? You know, Sammy, stay quiet. You just don't tell them. They're going to get very mad. They're going to get very mad if you tell them, you know, do you tell them that capitalism is just extracting their wealth and giving it to the rich? Well, the poor aren't going to like you for saying that, and the rich aren't going to. You just keep it quiet. Keep it, you know, with your marks. You know, don't say these things. You'll get us in trouble. It's very tricky. And I think your impulse as you look at the CDC and our government titrating information in ways that they think is appropriate for us and making the same mistake again and again and again, I think you as a journalist are going, look, this is not working. Let's just tell the truth as much as possible and see if they can handle that. Are you also telling truths about what we can do?
Well, yeah. I mean, by pointing out, here's what they're doing in Europe. We can do that. We because,
like, open the windows. What do we do?
Right. So, well, it's interesting. A study just came out, published in MMWR. That's the CDC's journal.
Yeah.
It just came out. Marin County. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah.
The Marin County. California. The Marin County study. So there was an outbreak in the school. Guess what? The classroom had. It was a teacher who was infected and infected a whole bunch of students in the classroom. There was a mask mandate in the school. Guess what else? The windows were open. Guess what else? There was a HEPA filter. I know Doug's face is aghast right now. So one of the things is, and I had a conversation with an infectious disease person last night who was upset with me about my article and reached out to me. And I said, I'd love to speak with you. I'm happy to, you know, I want to talk to anybody. Yeah. So we had to and I said, one of the things is, even if masks do work, let's put that aside. Let's grant that they're very effective. And again, when we say masks, we have to be very careful about what type of mask. But anyway, let's say the mask. I was very careful in my article to say mask mandates, not masks themselves. And the thing is compliance. And not only because the teacher, apparently, according to the study in the MMWR, in the CDC's journal, apparently the teacher pulled the mask down, his or her mask down, multiple times when they were reading because you know, no one can understand you or whatever. So they took
so then she spit all her COVID dust at the children.
Well, right. So part of the reason...
And it's very different. I mean, just... Teachers wearing masks is different than children wearing masks.
That's correct.
And I saw in the Johns Hopkins study that they said when teachers wear masks, it really does reduce the rate of COVID because they're speaking out and spraying all over the kids. But what is our responsibility and strategy as knowledgeable intellectuals in the press? How do we break this news to Americans in a way that doesn't simply inflame the conspiracy theorists? I mean, back before COVID, I was trying to write a piece about how we have to acknowledge the concerns of anti-vax people in order to sort of bring them into a more normal conversation. Because there are tiny but real risks. There are kids who've gotten fucked up from these things. If you shield someone from all information to the contrary, then they're more vulnerable to it.
This is not the way to bring people in by maligning, by belittling. That's not an effective strategy.
Right.
People who've been studying this stuff for years and who are sort of in the trenches working on stuff. And you saw this with the AIDS epidemic that happened, that when there is a kind of this dismissal of people in a way, now I can imagine some liberals thinking in their head right now, oh, so I have to worry about the snowflake, hurt feelings of some stupid conservative person who's like, who's afraid of the vaccine. You know, why is it my job to like have to like treat them with kid gloves and like I have to be nice to them? Well, I mean, whether that's the case or not, no one wants to be belittled and no one responds well to threats for like, you must do this or ultimatums.
It's a continuation.
It's not an effective public health strategy.
The basket of deplorables is killing us all.
It's not an effective strategy. Even if, so again, it's not that necessarily they're wrong in being pissed about some people for some of these things, but it certainly is not the way to bring people in. It just doesn't work. Instead, if you, there are a number of doctors who've talked about this where they said, I've had patients, doctors who are not just researchers, but who are seeing people clinically, and they say, I've had a lot of vaccine hesitant patients. And the way that I've gotten to change their minds, at least the people whose minds I change, wasn't by saying, are you a fucking moron? Come on, what are you talking about? Like, this is ridiculous. Get vaccinated. You are hurting society. You're an asshole. You're selfish. No. The way I got these people to change their mind was I sat down with them and I said, tell me what your concerns are.
Right.
And then they went through their list, whatever it may be. Obviously, if it's like a microchip person, maybe you can't reach them. But the people were like, well, I'm really worried. This is a new type of technology. I'm worried about, the side effect. Whatever it was, they went through all their concerns. And the doctor said, okay, let me talk with you about each of these things. And then they went through it.
You appeal to their autonomy.
I guess what I want to say is not all of these concerns are unreasonable or outlandish. So it's not just about, you have to treat them nicely because they're dumb and they're crazy. But if you treat them nicely, then they'll go along with the vaccine or these other things. No, it's not just about them being dumb or crazy. Some of their concerns are not unreasonable.
Right.
You just have to have a conversation. It is okay to recognize that bad things sometimes happen from something that overall is good.
Right.
Bad things happen on the highway every day, but we all get in our cars and go on the highway anyway because it does something good for us. It takes us to places we want to go, and we are willing to accept some risk. In the same reason that I got vaccinated, I knew there was some low-level risk. I was willing to accept that risk because overall, it was taking me somewhere I wanted to go.
Right.
When I talk with you, what's rewarding is you help bring out for me. And maybe you do this with your other guests too, or just like in life when you're talking to people, when you have a good conversation with someone, at least as a, if I can call myself an intellectual or a writer or whatever I am, that verbalizing a lot of this stuff helps me see the through line between different things that I'm writing about, whether it's the invisibles, whether it's about the book I was writing on self-consciousness, or whether it's the stuff I'm working on now with COVID, that in some regards, they seem very siloed. Oh, I'm bouncing around. But when I'm talking with you and having an interesting, long, open conversation, something that a podcast can do, the medium itself matters. Whereas if you're on a radio spot for 12 minutes or even that, when you have a long form conversation with someone who's curious and thoughtful and wise the way you are, that it helps me start verbalizing things. I'm like, oh my God, I'm seeing all these connections between all these different things that I think about and write about that I thought were different, but they actually, the way things can connect.
Yeah. Well, that's what I've always hoped for, this to be the conversational equivalent of a good jam band.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
Like the second act of a Fish concert or something, where it goes off and then it goes off in so many directions that you can see the whole again.
Exactly. That's the thing. Yeah. It's not just sort of like circuitous or something, that it actually, you start to see the patterns and start to see the connections, even when you let yourself sprinkle around.
It's an act of faith though. It's a leap of faith to go there. But when you do, it all starts to make sense again. So thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being on Team Human. Thanks for being on Team Human. Our guest today was David Zweig. You could read more of his stuff at Wired Magazine or at New York Magazine. Or you can go to teamhuman.fm and click on the links. And while you're there, you can also click on support to become a supporting member of the team. Team Human was produced by Joshua Chapdelin and edited by Luke Robert Mason. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.